It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The opioid epidemic is compounding the number of babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome. That's newborns in withdrawal after being exposed to these substances prior to birth. And now there's new research out on developmental delays later in life. The CDC, they estimate one baby is diagnosed with this syndrome every 19 minutes in our country. Call in with questions about neonatal abstinence syndrome, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Nicole Hennessy is a specialist in pediatric hospital medicine at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Dr. Hennessy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. So looking at this recent study by Epic Research found babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome are 68% more likely to have developmental disorders. How do these findings inform what you see in the first days of life as a pediatric hospital specialist?
So this is one of the first studies that's actually come out saying this. Most of our previous literature has not seen a major difference. I think the hard part to tease out is what of this is truly born in versus what is social development. I think that more than anything, despite the new research and literature, the entire study, if read through, actually continues to say what we've always known, which is our social supports and our social networks and close follow-up with our physicians and other healthcare providers is actually the most important thing. So that if there is a concern for developmental delay, it gets diagnosed early and taken care of early.
All right. So being in very close contact with that pediatrician and having good support systems, what can families do to reduce the negative impacts as the child ages if that is diagnosed at birth?
Again, going back to our social supports, people need to find their social supports kind of wherever they are. I think that sometimes when we talk about babies with neonatal abstinence syndrome, there's discussion of involving our child protective service in the county that they're living in. And it often comes off as the big bad wolf, that these are the people who are going to come in and take these babies away. And in fact, that's exactly the opposite of the goal in most situations. It really is getting the families the social supports that they need, whether that is other women who are dealing with the same issues or getting mom the ability to be working and good daycare for the child so that they are very much supported within the world they're living.
So how do physicians ensure patients are treated fairly despite the stigma of being dependent on drugs?
We work really hard to do significant education for ourselves and for the rest of our provider staff about opioid addiction and really working to take the stigma out of it so that when the families are with us, they don't feel that stigma and then therefore are more likely to come back and are going to continue care for their child. We really work hard to make sure that the families feel like they're part of our care instead of us being the care providers and telling them what to do.
How big of a concern is neonatal abstinence syndrome in Wisconsin compared to other states or national trends and data you watch?
The entire country, as you alluded to, is dealing with an opioid epidemic. I think that there are things put in place in our medical system now that is hopefully tapering it down some from a prescription opioid concerns, but there is still a significant amount of opioid concerns through street drugs or through taking true prescriptive drugs and selling them on the street. It's something that the entire country is seeing, and we in Wisconsin are definitely not any different than the rest of the country when it comes down to that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with pediatrician Dr. Nicole Hennessy about the effects of drug use on newborns and neonatal abstinence syndrome. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. In addition to opioids, studies show an increased risk of developmental disorders from using prescription medicines such as antidepressants or benzodiazepines. And I'm not saying that correctly, but how concerned should people be about taking their prescription meds during pregnancy?
I think that every medicine you're on deserves a discussion with your OB provider as to whether or not you should be continuing during the pregnancy. But often when it comes down to things like antidepressants or benzodiazepines, which are going to help you deal with anxiety, your mental state is really just as important for that baby as these potential risks. Again, they're potential risks and not something we see in every baby, let alone most babies. But what we do see is that women who struggle with anxiety through their pregnancy continue to struggle with anxiety after their pregnancy and leads to things that are really concerning, like postpartum depression and postpartum anxiety disorders, both of which can have significant consequences on the family and more specifically on the baby.
So what I'm hearing that in some cases, the pregnant person can't safely go off a prescription medication during their pregnancy. So what do you do in those cases to prevent neonatal abstinence syndrome?
So just making sure that the dose is the correct dose, that there's not an overabundance of the dose. There are sometimes medicines within the same class that we will switch to because we know that one has more negative effects on the infant versus another. But more than anything, really just having those open conversations with the families of things that we're potentially worried about so that we're all looking for any of those concerning features after birth.
What about maintenance drugs like Suboxone, methadone while pregnant? How would they affect a baby?
They're also opioids, although they're prescription. They are true opioids and can lead to having concerns with neonatal abstinence syndrome also afterwards. What is good with those drugs is that because they are being prescribed, there's no concerns for any sort of risky behavior going into needing to get the drug or that the drug is mixed with something else. One of the big concerns on the street drugs is that you don't really know what's in them. So you might think that you're getting heroin, but what you might also be getting is cocaine or something else. So we're able to control what is coming into the woman's body more specifically and know that exactly what's coming in is exactly what we are prepared for.
Is Suboxone tested for in newborn screenings, or what is part of that initial toxicology?
So any baby that is born to a mother that we know has a history of drug abuse is made aware of what we're doing, and they take a piece of their umbilical cord and are actually able to test on the umbilical cord more or less what the baby's been exposed to through the entire pregnancy.
If a baby is born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, you know, when you look at the standard hospital practices for the appropriate way to wean newborns, are there standard practices or how do you do that?
Yeah, there are definitely standard practices. We often will continue to encourage the mothers to breastfeed as long as they're not using street drugs. If the drug like Suboxone, as you alluded to, is prescribed, we will actually continue to encourage them to breastfeed so that the baby is getting a much significantly less amount of opioid, but can have more of a natural withdrawal from the opioid that their body is used to a larger amount. And now through breast milk, they're going to continue to get a smaller amount. But as that baby grows, the amount that they're getting through the breast milk stays consistent, but their body is growing. And so they're getting less and less per size of their body. The other thing that we do with every one of these babies is we watch them for at least 72 hours in the hospital. Really, again, working with the families as a partnership of checking the baby for neonatal abstinence syndrome. We ask ourselves kind of three questions. eat, sleep, and console. Is the baby able to eat well? Is the baby able to console well? And is the baby able to sleep well? They're much more intricate than that, and making it sound, but those are really the big three key questions. And if the baby's able to do all of those well within those first 72 hours, we let the baby go home with the family, knowing that that withdrawal is going to continue for days, if not weeks and months, as the opioids all kind of work out of the mother and the baby's system.
Dr. Nicole Hennessy with us, pediatric hospitalist, as we look at the health of newborns and new research on neonatal abstinence syndrome. Join in by calling with your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore new research into neonatal abstinence syndrome and the likelihood for developmental delays years later. Call in about opioid withdrawal in newborns, complications later in life, 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Nicole Hennessy here, a specialist in pediatric hospital medicine, and stays with us. Let's go to Alana in Rolling Ground this morning. Hi, Alana.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
My nephew had a child who was born narcotics addicted, and he just had a lot of good intuition and did a lot of skin-to-skin time. He did eat okay, but he was not consolable and did not sleep. And then he would swaddle him and kind of sleep with him braced between his legs, and that was the only thing that would calm him and keep him from crying. So anyway, he is five now and seems brilliant and well adjusted, though I'm wondering if there's any research about what happens when hormones hit and kids start being exposed to mind-altering substances. And the other thing I wanted to say is that I know I'm an occupational therapist, and I work with some pretty brilliant pediatric therapists who do sensory integration and reflex integration. And if kids are born that way, if they get assessed for those problems somewhere in the first couple of years, a lot of times things can get really well integrated. So thanks for what you do, and I'm going to sign off. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Alana, for bringing that personal perspective. Dr. Hennessy, go ahead.
I think the occupational therapist part is a huge part of it. At Gunderson, we actually involve our occupational therapists within the first 24 hours with every one of these babies, honestly, to do exactly what it sounds like your nephew did, teaching them what we call non-pharmacologic therapies, so that if the babies are having signs of withdrawal, that we don't need to treat them with medicine, and in fact can treat them with, as you said, swaddling, frequent feeding, those kind of non-pharmacologic therapies. But our occupational therapists do a phenomenal job, and I agree, early use of them is important.
Is there any research on what happens later in life when, you know, this young person might be exposed to alcohol or drugs? Is there any research insights?
There is some research to show that these children tend to have higher levels of addiction. But it is unclear, again, if it is due to being born with drugs in their system, or if it is just in the genes that people who have concerns with addiction, that their children in general are more likely to have concerns with addiction.
Can we go back to the pregnancy here? What is happening physiologically to a fetus when substances are taken? What's going on in utero?
So anything that goes into a mom's body ends up going into the baby's body because the blood all crosses the placenta. There are definitely substances that we worry more about even than opioids going into a mother's and therefore baby's system. Things like cocaine, they cause your body to vasodilate, which means let the blood vessels get even bigger. And that can lead to problems with the placenta. It can lead to problems with blood flow to the baby and those kind of things. So again, anything that's coming into mom can affect her own body, which can lead to concerns with the placenta and the baby, but also those drugs can get into the baby directly.
And just for clarity, after birth, what are the symptoms that you're looking for in neonatal abstinence syndrome?
That's a great question. Babies don't have a lot of ability to show us a ton of different things, but things that we're looking for is inconsolability, high-pitched, frequent crying, needing to suck often or feed frequently, vomiting, yawning, diarrhea, really the same things that an adult would go through with withdrawal. We're looking for the equivalence in babies.
We're talking about child, fetal, and maternal health with Dr. Nicole Hennessy here, specialist in pediatric hospital medicine at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. You know, doctors around our state, I just want to switch gears here, are really dealing with RSV and respiratory infections in children. How is this outbreak affecting the La Crosse area?
So working in the hospital, it's affecting us a great amount. When I look at the data over the last 6 to 8 weeks, there are very few beds available in the state of Wisconsin now for children, which is a very surprising and rare thing. We are unfortunately in La Crosse getting phone calls from all over Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, asking if we have open beds to take patients that need to be hospitalized. We're really in a bit of the equivalent of what the adult world was in 2020 with COVID. That's kind of where we are now, that we are looking for how can we find more beds? How can we find more nurses? How can we find more providers?
How do you treat RSV once the baby or child is hospitalized?
Unfortunately, there isn't a medicine for RSV, so it ends up being very symptomatic care. Often what they need is oxygen to help keep the oxygen in their blood up. We also use a special kind of oxygen flow called high flow oxygen. And what that does is put a little extra pressure into their lungs so that their lungs stay more open and they don't have to work so hard to breathe. They don't have to breathe so fast or so hard.
When does a parent know it's time to go into the ER? They perhaps have been in contact with their pediatrician about what they're seeing at home. When do you go in?
In little babies especially, if they're having any sort of trouble feeding, making sure you're coming in then. Otherwise, other things to look for is if the baby's breathing really fast or using kind of their stomach muscles to breathe, kind of that their belly is coming in and out different from their chest. Other things that you'll see is that their skin will start to pull in between their lungs or between their ribs, excuse me, or up on top of their rib cage, kind of up in their neck. So when they're just having that extra work of breathing, that's really when we'd want to see them.
How long are these young patients in the hospital for RSV typically?
This is an interesting year in that typically I would say kids are in the hospital for 2 or 3 days usually with us, and we're seeing kids needing to stay significantly longer than that, 5, 7, 10 days even. So the RSV that we're seeing this season not only is infecting a lot of kids, it's making them more seriously infected and have more longer infections.
Why do you think this seasonal outbreak is so significant, so much more severe?
I think what we're seeing is the ramifications of the good things we did during COVID, but now seeing the bad or negative side of it. What we did was we shut down schools and we had everybody in masks. So we have an entire population of children now that we're not shutting down schools and now that really almost nobody is masked, that is being exposed to things that typically they would have been exposed to at 6 months or a year old, and now are 2 or 3 and getting exposed for the first time. So we're seeing such a larger amount of children who really have what seem like infant immune systems. So typically we would only be seeing kind of 1 year's worth of kids, and we're seeing more like 3 years worth of kids all getting sick right now.
And we're almost out of time here, but when typically does RSV subside?
You can get it throughout your entire life. Adults get it too, but we've been exposed to it before. And so our bodies are already used to seeing it. In adults, it's really just the common cold, and we would just never put the name to it. We just put the name to it in kids and infants because we know it can cause a more serious infection in those younger ages.
Dr. Hennessy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Nicole Hennessy is a specialist in pediatric hospital medicine at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Transportation Department has this bulleted list of driving tips, like don't drive when you are angry, upset, or overly tired. Here's another one. Driving should not be a race unless you are driving a race car on a privately owned track. And here's one in bold. Treat others the way you would like to be treated. A little golden rule there, huh? Bring your driving advice, 800-642-1234. Aaron Chapin is McFarland Chief of Police and a police instructor at Madison College. Chief Chapin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
You've worked in law enforcement for more than two decades. You train police officers. Is driving becoming safer or more treacherous out there from your perspective?
I think we've seen a couple of trends recently that there has been an increase in dangerous driving behavior, particularly throughout 2020 when there were less people on the roads. There was less law enforcement action because agencies were concerned about officers contracting COVID and not quite sure how to address those issues. So there was less enforcement. And then I think that turned into some more dangerous driving behavior, which is carried into what we're seeing today.
You mean that people thought they could get away with going way over the speed limit? I mean, look, we're seeing tickets excess 100 miles an hour with speeding tickets way up in that category. What's going on?
I think there's a couple of things to that. I don't know that the COVID time period and the dangerous driving behavior that we saw during 2020 leads to that excessive driving behavior, but there have been things going on that we've seen where there is that excessive type of behavior. The city of Madison, Dane County Sheriff's Office, their traffic teams are out there and are seeing those cases where they're stopping people for doing 30 or 40 miles an hour over the speed limit. So I do think that there is a piece of it that people think that, or some people think that there's not a likelihood that they are going to get stopped, which could drive that behavior.
Electric cars are becoming incredibly fast, capable of going from 0 to 60 in a few seconds. Are speedier vehicles causing safety issues?
I think the thing to keep in mind is that people's behavior is the ultimate reason for that. Whether the machine is capable of doing it or not isn't driving the decision of the driver to do that. But there could be people that are choosing to do more risky behavior and engaging in that type of dangerous driving behavior.
But
I don't think it's electric cars completely, or muscle cars, or you know, the type of vehicles that are out there, because there's a lot of vehicles out there that are capable of driving well over 100 miles per hour. But many drivers are choosing not to engage in that risky behavior.
A little follow-up there, though, as we talk about that, because Teslas, they come, you know, with these advanced hardware capabilities of providing autopilot and self-driving software capabilities. Are officers worried about those features, seeing, you know, as we see more and more Teslas on the road?
I think there could be a little bit of cause for concern, because you're taking the human element out of decision making, and technology is not perfect. So that is a concern from my perspective. When I was a patrol officer, I did a lot of traffic. I'm a radar instructor, so I teach police officers how to utilize radar to stop speeders. And we know that increased speed is a significant factor in increasing the fatality risk if there is a crash that's caused. So if we're taking the human element out of vehicles and driving vehicles, that can create or could create a cause for concern. I think as technology continues to increase, that technology could get better, but the reality is that it's still technology and it can fail.
Let's bring on a caller now. Eric is with us in Stratford. Eric, hi. Eric, can you hear us?
Yes, hello.
Hi, yes. What are you encountering?
Well, I'm just wondering why motorists are allowed to drive with animals on their lap, their heads are hanging out the window. I mean, isn't that a form of distracted driving also?
Okay, I want to repeat that for you, Chief Chapin. People driving with their pets on their lap, animals with heads out the window, isn't that a form of distracted driving?
I think ultimately for distracted driving, for us to be able to enforce it from a law enforcement perspective, we have to be able to show that there are decisions or things that the driver is doing that does divide the attention. There are boatloads of things out there that drivers do that are dangerous. I've seen in my personal vehicle when I've been driving around, people who are putting on makeup or eating breakfast, you know, bowl of cereal as they're driving down the road, which clearly in a situation where you've got what's called divided attention, driving requires divided attention. We're doing multiple things. We're watching traffic around us. We're having to check blind spots. We're looking at mirrors. We're using our turn signal, pushing on the accelerator, steering. All of those things, there's divided attention tasks that are occurring. And if we're adding something else into the mix that's allowing us or prohibiting us from being able to make good decisions and to be able to control that vehicle safely, it could be considered distracted driving. But from an enforcement standpoint, we need to be able to show that the behavior that the driver is engaged in is truly distracted for us to be able to write a citation.
And on that laundry list of distractions in the vehicle, I would imagine smartphones are near the top of the list.
Absolutely. Yeah, the more technology that we've got in our hands, the greater the increase for potential issues related to distracted driving.
We're talking about driver safety with McFarland Police Chief Aaron Chapin. You can join in on what you've seen, tips and advice, 800-642-1234, and keeping safe behind the wheel. Let's go to Tom now in Kenosha. Tom, hi.
Hello.
Hi, we can hear you.
Okay. I just had a couple points. One was, you know, to what extent do, like, car manufacturers bear responsibility for some of the excessive speeds? You know, I've seen more supercars on the road than ever in history, you know, primarily Chrysler products, although I understand Chrysler is not going to be building the Chargers and Challengers much longer. And secondly, is it because there's a paucity of driver education that may, you know, explain some of the lack of, you know, knowledgeable behavior about, you know, the rules of the road and proper etiquette?
Chief Chapin, go ahead on those two questions.
So I think vehicle manufacturers, they do things to try to be in compliance with NHTSA, which is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, national DOT and state DOT regulations, to try to make things as safe as possible because they do have a vested interest in it, but they also have to look at their market as well. So there are competing interests there. Vehicles that are out there today have got, for instance, Teslas, other EVs, and actually not even just EVs, but you see big display screens and things like that in vehicles. The vehicle manufacturers typically will disable a bunch of the functionality of that unless the vehicle is at a stop, so that we are trying to limit the amount of distracted driving that drivers are doing. But you have to think through things like your climate controls are incorporated into that, the radio, stuff like that. So there still are things that drivers are touching and utilizing during the their trips to be able to control climate, radio, and things like that in their vehicles. So so I think that vehicle manufacturers, as much as they can, are trying to balance that.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, driver behavior is up to the person who's behind the wheel, and we need to look at that as the major factor, not necessarily the machine and blaming the machine.
Is there
the second question?
Yes. Is there anything that can be done in driver education? What needs to change there?
So I'm not sure that at the, 15 or 16 year old driver education level. And I've actually got a daughter who's just going through driver's ed right now, the fourth of my children to go through. There is a lot of talk about distracted driving, about intoxicated driving, things like that, those dangerous behaviors, things that we know increase risk. So I think driver education is trying to address that. But as we add additional instruction into driver's education, there's new technology that comes out or different statistical points and things like that. So it's a matter of trying to stay ahead of that.
Mm-hmm.
Not
mm-hmm.
quite sure what the perfect solution to that would be.
Rodney in Madison called, couldn't stay on the line. And Rodney was riding their bike, was hit by a car, had to go to the hospital, and noticed in the police report that the driver was not ticketed, and wants to know, is that common? What are the consequences when a driver hits a biker?
Sure. It depends on the every case is different. So the officers have to look at the case, the totality of the case, and figure out what the cause is. And in some circumstances, if it's an accident that was completely out of control of either individual, which sometimes that occurs, officers typically won't issue a citation because was there a behavior that the driver did, or did the driver just not see something, and the officer could tell that the driver or the cyclist or whoever was involved in the crash is being truthful about the circumstances. Officers have discretion to choose not to issue citations. So it really depends on the particular facts of the case. And I can't speak for that particular circumstance, but I've investigated crashes in the past where I've chosen not to issue citations because of the facts that if there really is a significant contributing factor where the driver was, for instance, on their cell phone and texting, I'd write that ticket every day because that cause for that accident absolutely, can be contributed back to that. Or if it was a drunk driver, that arrest, I'm going to make that arrest every day, and I would expect that out of my team members.
We're getting safe driving tips from McFarland Police Chief Aaron Chapin with us with more than two decades of experience on the force. Join in on how you deal with scary situations on the road, what you've encountered, how you've reacted as a driver or passenger in those situations. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we get driving tips from a police chief, here are a couple more from the State Transportation Department. Relax. Take a deep breath. Getting stressed and upset will probably not get you there any faster, it says, and it might shorten your life. And go ahead and be late. It won't kill you to be 10 minutes late for an appointment. McFarland Police Chief Aaron Chapin stays with us for more tips. Chief Chapin, how can drivers stay alert and focused when there are so many distractions on the road?
That's a great question. I think one of the biggest things is to do what we can to make sure that we're limiting distractions within our vehicle. my wife and I have made intentional efforts to talk to our kids about distracted driving, and particularly in the area of cell phones. So we had a rule for our kids that if they were going to be driving, that the cell phone went in the back seat of the car so they're not tempted or they're not playing around with the cell phone instead of driving. That they would text us and say, hey, I'm leaving right here. The cell phone goes in like the pocket of the back seat or on the back seat of the car. They drive wherever they're going to go. Once they got there, they would text us, say, hey, I made it safely, and then move on. So limiting those distractions. inside your vehicle makes it much easier to pay attention to what's going on outside the vehicle and to be able to operate the vehicle in a safe and efficient manner.
I would tack on to that being a role model as the adult driver and modeling that for your kids who see how you use your phone.
Absolutely. Yeah, because do what I say and not what I do is not the way to end up showing leadership and to instill good behaviors into other individuals. We model what we see. We do the things that we see as opposed to what we hear typically.
Let's bring in Elizabeth in Milwaukee. Elizabeth, you've been driving out west. What did you encounter?
Speed limits can be 70 or 80. So if it's 80, people are driving 90, 95. If it's 70, they're driving 80, 85. So I politely go to the right, put my right turn signal on. I wave to people because I don't want to get other people agitated. I don't want to feel agitated, and I don't want to spend time with car insurance accidents. So they all zoom by. But the question on the table is, the speed limit is 70. The speed limit is 80. If you knock it down, people are going to go 10 to 15 over anyway. So why keep increasing it? Because people are just speeding 10 to 15 over. And I witnessed that within the 5,000 miles I drove. And it was concerning. And then one time, and I'm just going to make a joke, everybody goes, 35, 40, and then everybody stops at the stop sign. And I asked a gentleman, I said, sir, could you let me know, are we all here to stop so that we can all go and discuss what brake shop we're going to go to get our brakes fixed? It's like, what is the point of speeding up to a red light and then stopping? It doesn't make sense to me. So it's
Elizabeth, thank you for bringing your experiences. Chief McFarland, what about those speed limits as they increase?
That's a great point, because I think we see that particularly in Madison on the Beltline. You've got interstates that are around us. The interstates are at 70. People will come off the interstate onto the Beltline and still drive like at 70, but the speed limit there is 55. I think there's a handful of things that can help. I do think that enforcement is something, education and enforcement together, but enforcement is a piece of it. If people don't think that they're going to get cited, and the risk of driving 7 to 10 over or 10 to 15, 15 to 20 over, if I've never been cited or never been stopped and I've driven past law enforcement, that reinforces the behavior. So doing additional enforcement, I think, is beneficial. As far as continuing to increase speed limits, we know that relative risk of fatality increases significantly as we increase the speed. We've got issues of a vehicle travel 1.1 feet per mile per hour. So a vehicle that's traveling 70 miles per hour is going to travel 77 feet per second. So it's moving pretty quickly. And we know that there's an issue with reaction time. The average human, it takes them 3/4 of a second to react to a stimulus. So as you're driving and the person brakes in front of you, for you to choose to make the decision to brake, it's at least 3/4 of a second on average for you to recognize that something has changed in your sphere and then to make the movement to change. So in 3/4 of a second, you've traveled a significant distance. And if we continue to increase those speeds, we're increasing the amount of distance a vehicle is traveling in that time. So if there's dangerous behavior going on and you don't have the time and the opportunity to change what you're doing, that creates a problem.
That math doesn't work in your favor. Let's go to Diane in Greenfield. Diane, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm having issues with when I'm either biking or walking across the pedestrian crossings. I was told by a police officer that vehicles are supposed to stop, but for the most part, none of them do. And in the area that I do want to cross, I've been noticing that let's say I'm a driver, because I also drive past that area, I'm noticing that the cars behind me are not slowing down, and I'm afraid I'm going to be rear-ended. I'm also noticing it's a two-lane road. I'm noticing the people, let's say, on my right or my left are not slowing down. So even if I stop the cars, they're going to hit the biker or the walker. And another thing I've just thought about while I was waiting is at the walk signs, the same thing is happening when the walk signs, turn on for the pedestrian. The
yes.
If there's a car that wants to turn right or left, they do it. And so you're kind of at the mercy of just having to watch.
Diane, thank you for that. Chief McFarland, help us out with these pedestrian first areas.
Sure. So state law does require drivers to yield to a pedestrian who has come to a crosswalk, whether it's marked or unmarked, and they've addressed the street saying that, or they've shown intention that they're planning to cross. So vehicles are supposed to yield and can be cited. I think it is important to recognize that if somebody is in the right, so the pedestrian is right to take the crosswalk, but they're not going to win against a car if there is a collision. So the pedestrian may need to make the choice to not cross and kind of deal with that situation, but they do have, the driver needs to yield right away to a pedestrian. As far as bicyclists, if a bicyclist is going to use the crosswalk, under state law, they need to do that in a manner consistent with that of a pedestrian. So popping into a crosswalk at 20 miles an hour doesn't give vehicle traffic enough time to slow down. But if the biker addresses the crosswalk the same way that a pedestrian does and then moves through the crosswalk similar to a pedestrian, they have the same rights as a pedestrian in that particular space.
Diane, thank you for the call. We also got an email from Sarah and said, look, they drive in both Milwaukee and rural areas, and Sarah experiences reckless driving in both areas and says this is definitely not an issue that is exclusive to our large cities in Wisconsin. What would you say there? Because, there are studies that have found most car accident fatalities happen on rural roads. Where, is this a universal issue?
I do think that it is. It's not just an urban issue, a suburban issue. Most county roads, most rural roads, speed limits have a tendency to be higher, and there's usually less vehicle traffic, which there could be a potential for drivers to kind of be paying less attention because there's not as much stuff vying for their attention in that particular space. The roadways that are out in rural areas are also typically narrower, don't have as wide of a shoulder or an opportunity for a driver to have a error that can be fixed while they're traveling down the road. So I do think it is important across the state on every highway to make sure that we're driving in a respectful manner, in a safe manner, watching out for not only us but other drivers on the road.
Chief Chapin, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me this morning. This was fun.
Aaron Chapin is McFarland Chief of Police and a police instructor at Madison College. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.